And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm delighted to welcome Kurt Wagner for the first of a two-part interview today. Kurt is an award-winning business and technology journalist covering social media for Bloomberg and has been writing about Twitter and other social media companies and their impacts on society since 2013. Kurt's debut book is Battle for the Bird, which is published by Simon & Schuster. So, Kurt, at what point in covering Twitter and the social media space for Bloomberg did you say, you know, this is a story that needs to be a book?
I felt like after the January 6th situation where Twitter finally suspended a sitting U.S. president, to me, it felt like that was this moment where the company had taken a drastic step that we hadn't seen in the industry, right? And I'd covered Twitter for a really long time, so I sort of knew there were a bunch of other interesting things about the company, its business that had happened. But to me, that sort of felt like a huge moment for them. I thought, okay, well, this sort of puts Twitter in a different light. It certainly made Twitter much more polarizing, right? There were people had very strong opinions on both sides of that situation. And so when I set out to write this book, I felt like that was actually going to be a major part of this. You know, the Elon stuff that ultimately ended up happening sort of came in after I was already committed to writing a book about Twitter. So it made it much more interesting. My timing was fortunate in terms of the Elon situation. But again, I feel like the suspension or the ban of President Trump was what really put this company on my radar as being like, okay, this seems like it has enough material for a book here.
And in your acknowledgments, you say that it was Jack Dorsey's second time leaving as CEO that you thought would be the natural end of the book. And then bang, you've got twice as much stuff to do, it seems.
Exactly. I mean, I was working on my book proposal at that point. And so when Jack Dorsey left Twitter, which was in, I believe, November of 2021, I was sort of like, okay, well, this is great. You know, there's my ending. Like, I can follow the career arc of this guy, which includes, you know, all the Trump stuff I just mentioned. And that'll feel like a nice, like, closing to this book. And then it's sort of funny, as I was talking with publishers about this, I was literally pitching them my proposal in March and April of 2022. That's when Elon showed up on the scene and really just, like, you know, completely changed the entire dynamic of the company and therefore, you know, the book.
This is your first book. Had you made other proposals before?
No, this was my first proposal, my first book. I'd covered Twitter for such a long time, and I'd always sort of felt like I did a good job covering Twitter. It felt like a company that I knew really well. It always felt like Twitter was going through something dramatic. And so I always thought if I wrote a book, this would be the thing I would care enough about to dive in on. And I really love the process. I would love to do another book someday, but I feel like I need to, one, see how this one does first, and two, catch up on some sleep before I ever endeavor on something like this again.
How does it feel writing a book about Twitter, one of the more established ways, we'll say, instead of just old ways of conveying information between people, and you're covering such a technology that's, you know, very much of the second, not even up to the minute, but up to the second?
I'm not a very patient person, I will say, and it was hard to sort of watch this story unfolding live and just like the speed at which news moves on Twitter and the speed of sort of new information about this particular story, you know, as you're watching all this happening and unfolding in real time and knowing, okay, I'm writing this book and it's not going to come out for, you know, a year or 6 months or whatever. It was very tough. It challenged my patience for sure, because, you know, you want it to be out right away. Like, you want it to be part of the discussion as it's unfolding. And that just isn't possible with a book. So I think if I were to do this again, you know, I mentioned how lucky I was that Twitter and Elon became the topic of the moment while I was writing this book. But at the same time, I think it would be sort of more enjoyable personally to write about something that's, you know, already done, that's not unfolding in real time, because that definitely adds another element, more of a mental element for me, the author, than anything.
In your bio, it says you live in Denver. Is that just a good middle ground so you can live halfway between Silicon Valley and Texas?
No. I wish we'd been that thoughtful about it. My wife grew up in Denver. I always kind of knew she was itching to come back. And then we have a couple kids now. And we were living in San Francisco, lived there for over a decade and really enjoyed it. I miss San Francisco. But once you have a couple kids, at least for us, it was time to be closer to family. So we just came back here to be near family. And I still make it out to the Bay Area somewhat regularly. And I'm also, you know, closer to New York now. And I always love going to New York. So hopefully I'll be out there a lot more often now as well.
Now, at the beginning, you say Dorsey nor Musk participated directly for the book. Had you ever had a chance to interview them before you started on the project?
I've spoken with Jack Dorsey a handful of times over the years in various kind of formats. Elon is someone I've never spoken with. We've exchanged one email. That was it. And, you know, I was a little bit worried, I think, when I first set out on this, like knowing that there was a real chance that neither of them spoke to me. But, you know, at a certain point, you start to talk to so many people. And I interviewed, you know, I think I said more than 150 people for this book. And at a certain point, you just start to feel that you can piece this thing together even without them. Now, not to say that it wouldn't have been helpful or beneficial, of course, to speak with them. But I think it forces you to compensate in other ways, like talking to literally everyone you can think of. And I think that's a good reporting tactic. So I'm really happy with how the reporting turned out, even though, you know, obviously the two main characters of the book chose not to participate.
So with over 150 interviews, how do you organize that huge stack of sources?
It is tough. A lot of spreadsheets, quite frankly, you know, keeping track of who I've reached out to and when I need to follow up with those people. You know, you spend a lot of time asking people for favors, you know, asking one source who is willing to talk to you, hey, who else should I speak with? Hey, would you mind introducing me, right? Because the introductions go such a long way. So I was very grateful that a lot of my Twitter sources were willing to connect me with their old colleagues or their friends. That made a huge difference. But it also helped that I'd covered the company so long, right? So even though I'd only maybe been reporting on this particular story for about a year, I had so much historical context and historical contacts in my phone already that I wasn't starting at zero, that's for sure. I felt like I kind of hit the ground running when I decided I wanted to do this.
How do you start to sort out the mythology from the true historical record?
This is tough because memory, of course, fades over time, right? A lot of people will remember things differently even if they're in the same room and intimately involved in it. And that was one of the things that I think you really kind of struggle with as you go through this process, or at least I did, is like, okay, person X, you know, tells me a story that they remember vividly, and you go to person Y, who was also there, and they remember it very differently, or they remember the main parts, but the specifics are different. And so I can't tell you how many times you kind of go back and forth, right, between folks, and you say, well, here's what I'm hearing from someone else, and, you know, does this make sense? Hey, do you have photos? Do you have audio? You know, trying to sort of like piece these things together as best you can, because memory is fallible. And so I think, you know, when you talk about the myth versus the reality, it's sort of the same steps, right? You do your very best to say, here's what people think they know or what they remember. Can we actually pinpoint this with some real hard data, right? Can we find photos? Can we find milestones that sort of uphold this idea? It's tedious, as you can imagine, but I feel like that's the only really way to do this kind of thing, is to try and just kind of pressure test what you're hearing from one person against what you're hearing from other people.
Do you think it feels a little bit like an attorney trying to develop a narrative for a big court case?
I think so. I was thinking it was more, you know, I love history, and it really felt like you're just piecing together this puzzle, right? You get one piece from someone and you don't exactly even know where it fits in, but you know, it fits somewhere. And to me, that was sort of the way I was thinking of it, is like every little incremental bit of information I then had to sort of, you know, tease out more info from other people, right? And I think people are more excited and eager to talk to you when they think you're kind of already onto something. And so I usually had most success with sources when I came to them and already had a general understanding of what, you know, or at least what I thought was going on, right? Like very few people want to be the very first one to paint a picture for you. But if they think you're close, or they think you've gotten 80% of the way there, they want to help you get that final 20%. And so it really does snowball off of each other once you start learning some of this information.
Besides the two principals, is there someone else that you wish you would have had access to for the writing of the book?
There are. I'm reluctant to get into specific names because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to say who I did or did not speak with beyond those Elon and Jack. I felt like readers sort of deserve to know that I did not speak to those two. Other than that, I don't really want to get into the who I did or didn't talk to thing. But there were definitely people I did not talk to that I was bummed about. And at the same time, there were people who spoke to me that I didn't expect would be willing to. The one thing that was tough for me going through this, because I feel like maybe I'm more emotional than I should have been, is like the highs and lows, man. It's like a 2-year process. Some days, you know, a source would reject you and you just feel terrible. At least I did. I'd be like, I can't believe they don't want to talk. Like, this book is going to be terrible. What have I done? And then the very next day, you know, another source says, yeah, sure, let's chat. Like, let's meet for coffee. And you're like, wow, this is going to be the best book ever. I can't believe they said yes. And it's just funny, the waves that you ride, at least the waves that I rode as I went through this thing, which is a long time. You know, 2 years working on this is a long time to ride those waves. So I think if I did another book, I'd have to sort of figure out a way to keep those emotions a little bit more in check.
Yeah, that endurance, because in writing for print or publication, you always have the next story that you can move on to. But this one, you've got to sit with it for a good long while.
You do. I mean, I did end up publishing a lot of stuff along the way just because the story was literally unfolding while I was doing the reporting. And so there were certain things that would come up in my reporting that just, you know, I didn't feel like I could sit on. Part of that was like an obligation to Bloomberg, but part of that was also just knowing how this information gets out. And I was like, well, either I could be the first one to get it or someone else is going to beat me to it because it's not going to hold for 6 months. It's not going to hold for 8 months, right? And so you sort of have to weigh that stuff in the moment and use your best judgment. There were a few like historical aspects of the book, like some new information from years ago that I saved for the book for sure. But a lot of the stuff that was unfolding in real time with Elon, you know, if I found it, learned about it, and it felt like it was newsy in that moment, I tried to get it out there and figured, well, it'll be in the book as well for those who don't see it live.
Let's actually get into the history of Twitter. What and when do you think kind of the earliest concept that actually became Twitter, when did it happen, and what was that original first idea?
Well, the company started in 2006, I believe March of 2006, but co-founder Jack Dorsey had sort of been noodling on this idea of a digital away message was sort of the best way to describe it. So I don't know if you ever used, you know, AOL Instant Messenger, or folks who are listening are familiar with that product, but
AIM,
exactly. You could say like, hey, you know, I'm stepping away from the computer because I'm going to have dinner, or I'm stepping away to do whatever. And this idea of an away message, like, what are you up to right now, really captivated Jack Dorsey. And so he'd been thinking about it for several years before Twitter ever materialized, but it was just an idea. It was just sort of like this thought, like, can we do this, but do it on the go, right? Do it mobile instead of sitting at a computer. And that was the genesis for what Twitter ultimately became. And, you know, I want to be careful because it wasn't just Jack. Like, even though Jack Dorsey was sort of the one thinking about this, it was truly a handful of people who came up with this company and built this company. But I think that is really like the foundation of this away message idea, this status update that ultimately became Twitter.
The character limit was based on kind of the character limit of SMS text messaging at the time. Was that a necessary part of the technology, or is it just easier to understand?
I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, it was sort of necessary because they didn't want to be, you know, if someone's writing a novel, they don't want to have to send, you know, 1,000 text messages for people to read a post, right? Not only would that have been very expensive because Twitter was paying for the delivery of these messages, but it also would have just been like a terrible user experience to say, I follow you and you write a 10,000 word post and now I'm getting 100 text messages from you. That's just not a very great way to experience that. So that was part of it. But then I think that constraint, that 140 character limit, ultimately like became a defining feature of what made Twitter great, right? Because it forced people to really be thoughtful in what they wanted to say. You know, you're more concise, you're more creative because you have to like get your ideas into this very short amount of space. Obviously, there's downsides to this as well. You lose a lot of nuance, of course, and we can talk about that. But I do think the 140 character constraint was both like a business and tech necessity, but it ended up being a really helpful part of the product and what made the product unique in those early days.
Now, you mentioned other people were, of course, involved with the company, and one of the co-patent holders is a man named Biz Stone. How did he manage to avoid all this drama?
Biz was never the CEO. And so there were two co-founders who were CEOs, Jack Dorsey and Ev Williams. They had to deal with the board. They had to deal with each other, quite frankly. There was some jealousy between the two of them. You know, being the leader is like everyone guns for you, right? Everyone holds you to a different standard or account. And Biz was never the CEO. So he sort of always had the luxury of being very intimately involved, but without necessarily all of the responsibility that comes with that position. And so he was sort of able to maintain friendships with both Ev and Jack and sort of you know, be the middleman between that whole thing. But I would say you don't get as much credit and attention when you're not the CEO, but you avoid a lot of the negative stuff that can come with that position as well.
Our personality and intellectual characteristics that might make us a good creator, able to synthesize new ideas and put things in a new context, aren't necessarily what's greatest for a CEO. So what were Dorsey's strengths that allowed him to actually operate for at least a time in the CEO role? And what were his characteristics that were not serving that role well?
He was very creative. I think he thought of himself as an artist almost more than anything. I think when you're building something from zero, that's an incredibly great skill to have, right? He just thought about things differently, right? He saw something that he liked, this AOL Instant Messenger status update, and said, you know, how can I move that? How can I take that on the go? How can I fit that into my life in a different way? And, you know, it sounds obvious now because we all use it, but those types of things weren't obvious back then. And I feel like he, you know, should get credit for kind of thinking outside the box in that way, which is how most, you know, founders operate. They just think differently about these products and these ideas. And Jack was no different there. But as you point out, that doesn't make you a great CEO. And he was not a great CEO, especially in 2008 when he was first there. You know, he was very distracted. He had a lot of hobbies. He cared about sewing. He cared about yoga. He was big into music. Like, there were just like a lot of things that mattered to him beyond just building this business. And when you're a startup founder in particular, you kind of got to be 110% focused on the business, because otherwise it'll eat you up. And I think that was his biggest downfall that first time around when he was the CEO at the very beginning, was that he just wasn't committed in the way that he needed to be. You know, that happens to a lot of founders at that stage. But for him, he learned a lot from that, I imagine. And he was a different person when he came back to the company in 2015. But I think, you know, he always held that sort of desire to have a lot of different hobbies and interests. That was something that that hadn't changed by 2015. I just think he'd gotten a little bit better at the business side of things.
Do you think that willingness to like commit oneself utterly to something to the exclusion of other parts of their life is sometimes not the best way to run our business world on the planet?
Yeah, I do. I think it's really useful to have other things going on that you care about, right? It like helps give you perspective. It helps avoid burnout. I just think that when you are starting something, you don't necessarily have that luxury on day one, right? Unfortunately, a lot of these companies, when they get up and running, they require that full undivided attention until they can get to a place where it's like, all right, I'm able to spend the weekends, you know, doing my other hobbies or my other interests. But oftentimes early on, that's just not a luxury that a lot of people have. And I think, you know, Twitter, unfortunately, was not really any different.
So many of the social media companies, ultimately, what they are is advertising companies. Mm-hmm. And they're just leveraging their platform to get eyeballs for ads. Why was Twitter not able to compete like with the Facebooks, Instagrams, and such, and be able to convert that attention time into money?
Yeah, it's a great question, because they always lagged behind these other platforms, as you mentioned, on the business side. And I think it comes down to kind of two things. Like, one is a simple one to understand, which is just audience. Twitter was much smaller than Facebook or Instagram, as much smaller than Google or YouTube. So from a pure number standpoint, there just wasn't as many people to reach. And therefore, you know, there were fewer advertisers interested in advertising there. And even if they did, it was cheaper to do so because you're not reaching as many people, right? I think the one that's probably even more important, but maybe a little harder to understand for folks who just aren't in the industry, is that Twitter never really built the types of ads that are most lucrative. So there's kind of two main types of digital ads. There's what's called brand advertising, which is the digital equivalent of a TV commercial, right? Coca-Cola or Disney or Apple. And they're not trying to sell you something right then and there, but they're trying to make you feel more positively towards their company and their brand. And that's what Twitter specialized in, right? A lot of their ads were sort of like digital billboards. And what Google and Facebook, now Meta, ultimately ended up doing was going into what are called direct response ads. So these are much more targeted ads. So instead of just trying to make you feel good about Apple, you know, they're trying to get you to their website to buy a pair of AirPods, or they're, you know, a game developer is trying to get you to the App Store to download their mobile game. And these are much more specific types of ads but they're much more lucrative because if they work, you know, you're driving a direct sale, you're driving a direct download or whatever, and they require not only better technology to make sure that they work, right? You need to be able to track these things, but they also require more data. So that's one of the reasons like Google and Meta are so good at them is they have so much data about people. They can show you these really targeted ads. And Twitter just never really made that a priority. They never collected the data you needed to do this, and they never built the technology needed to do these types of ads. And unfortunately, as time went on, those became the place where most people were spending money, and Twitter was sort of, you know, lagging behind because they were dealing in this brand advertising space.
In that, you have to have people who understand psychology and anthropology because you have to be able to leverage information about people's attitudes and behaviors to make it effective.
It's pretty remarkable when you look at the technology that, you know, we'll say Google is using, right? Because not only are you probably using a Google browser, but you might be using Google's Maps and Google's email. And, you know, they just have so many touch points into your life that they're able to create this picture of who you are and what you care about. And even if you're anonymous to Google, they know the basics and they can say, we know that males of this age who live in this area tend to like these things. And therefore, you know, voila, your ads feel very relevant and you're more likely to click on them or to buy from them. And, you know, think about what you needed to sign up for Twitter. You basically needed an email address. You could be anonymous. You didn't have to give them your name. You didn't have to tell them where you lived. And these are all things that I think, you know, made Twitter both appealing because it didn't feel quite as intrusive as a Google or Facebook, but it also sort of set it up for a real challenging business environment for the company.
I sure wish Google would get enough information on me to stop trying to show me Ben Shapiro videos on YouTube.
There you go. You just need to start hiding them. Start hiding them, and maybe they'll pick up the tip there.
Man, no matter how much I hit, not interested. They keep giving them to me. Another aspect of Dorsey's personality that you talked about, kind of conflict averse, sometimes didn't like to make the big decision on things, kind of try to distribute that as much as possible. And I mean, the buck does stop at the CEO, and he sometimes just seemed to want to not have to make those decisions.
I think this was one of the things that surprised me as I started reporting this book, how intentionally hands-off he was because of what you just said. He didn't like making decisions. There's a quote somewhere in there. I heard him speak at an event once, and he basically said, I'm paraphrasing now, that, you know, if he has to make a decision, it's a failure of his own leadership because he hasn't set people up in a way that, you know, they're able to do it on their own. It's a very different way of leading, especially it's very different than other tech CEOs and tech luminaries, right? So like Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos, and certainly Steve Jobs when he was still alive, like those are examples of CEOs who are very opinionated. They know what they want to build. They have a sense of what they want it to look like and how they want it to feel. And other people are sort of carrying out, you know, in a lot of ways, their vision. And Jack was just different than that. He sort of felt like he should be advising people, but ultimately letting them make the decisions. And that can work. I think if you have a really, really strong, you know, executive team reporting to you, but I also think it can lead to a bunch of kind of paralysis because people are reluctant to make a decision. You know, they want to do something that's going to please the boss, but they don't know what the boss wants. And so they kind of try a bunch of different things, or they half try a bunch of different things. And I think Twitter suffered as a result of this approach and philosophy from Jack, and company moved really slow for a long time because it didn't have a central leader that was really sort of like forcing the company in a particular direction.
We're centered in Memphis, and Memphis has two very famous cases of founders of companies who got leveraged out of their companies. First up is Clarence Saunders, who invented self-service grocery stores with Piggly Wiggly, and then Kimmins Wilson, who invented Holiday Inn. Both of them kind of got chucked out of their own companies by the boards. How did this happen to Dorsey with Twitter?
Yeah, so I assume you're talking about the first go around in 2008. So he was, you know, CEO for maybe, I'm doing the math in my head, I think just over a year. And, you know, the biggest issue was he didn't have any control of the company. I think he owned maybe 3%, but certainly not a significant enough ownership stake to sort of protect his own job, right? And so...
And they didn't have a preferred type of stock that would allow him more power.
That's right. They had a single class of stock, which, you know, wouldn't really come in until later. when they went public. But I should say it mattered then, but it continued to matter when they went public several years later. But so, you know, he owns 3% of the company and has 3% of the vote. And so when the board felt that he wasn't performing well, you know, I mentioned he had a lot of hobbies. There were some details about him going to sewing class or going to yoga class or whatever, skipping out of work a couple hours early to go do these other hobbies. And when things are not going well, the board sort of used that as, okay, well, here's this guy who's not giving us his 100%. And he didn't have any way to protect himself. And so he got booted out in 2008. And, you know, he took that very personally, as you might imagine, because it was a company that he'd co-founded. He felt very intimately involved in. And suddenly they said, we don't want you anymore. I think that sort of set the stage for his relationship with Twitter's board forever for the rest of his tenure there. But certainly that iteration of the board was, you know, a group that he was not happy with.
There are echoes all over this book. And one of them that I found pretty interesting is that Jack Dorsey, after leaving Twitter the first time, becomes involved with Square. And then, of course, later on, Elon Musk wants to turn Twitter into X, which would also be big in the payments world as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, that some of the echoes are, in this case, very much Elon related. Elon had wanted to build payments. He was a co-founder of PayPal. So, you know, he had a long history of payments. I think was very excited to sort of see what Twitter and now X could become on the payment space. But you're right, like Jack Dorsey has an entire payments company that he still runs. So I think there was a connection there, certainly a shared understanding of the power of payments and the potential of payments that those two had. I have to imagine that, you know, when this takeover was going down and they were talking, that the payments thing was probably a shared vision for what Twitter could become.
How did Dorsey come back to Twitter?
So in 2015, Twitter's then CEO, Dick Costolo, was stepping down and the board was looking for his replacement. And Jack was still a board member. So he was involved in the company, but not on a, I would say, like day-to-day basis. But he was there. He was peripheral. And the feeling at that time when Dick Costolo stepped down was that Twitter needed a product person to take over, because the feeling was that the company's flaw was that its product wasn't growing fast enough. And if they could find, you know, a silver bullet to make Twitter, the app, feel more appealing to people, then the business would follow behind. And so the board sets out to replace Dick and is really looking for a product person. And here you have Jack Dorsey, the co-founder, who's sitting on the board. And obviously he had failed his first time as CEO. But since then, he had built Square, and he'd built it into a multi-billion dollar business that I think impressed a lot of the board members. And I think a lot of them thought, okay, here's a guy who knows the product as well as anybody. He's sort of considered a product genius. He's already on the board, so we sort of have him vetted in that way. And he's proven to us that he's grown up since 2008 when he was fired, because we have Square as this example. And so he ended up getting the job again in 2015 for all those reasons, and sort of getting a second crack at this thing because he'd proven to them, or, you know, they certainly felt that he had proven that he had grown up a lot since the last time he had been running the company.
And this is kind of echoes of Steve Jobs' return to Apple.
Oh yeah, Jack Dorsey would be thrilled to hear that comparison, because there was a time a few years before this where I think he greatly admired Steve Jobs, and I think he sort of likened himself to a Steve Jobs type person. But yes, I mean, it's not only is that the only comparison, but also like the running two companies at once thing was a something that Steve Jobs did as well, and Jack Dorsey was able to do with both Square and Twitter. It's a rare thing. Very few, you know, CEOs ever run two companies simultaneously. And the only ones I can actually really think about are Steve Jobs, Jack Dorsey, and coincidentally, Elon Musk.
Yeah, because that is another echo. The board had its concerns about his divided interest, and then they probably got the most divided interest CEO in the country to buy it.
Yeah, I know. It's quite ironic. I remember tweeting something to that extent when the deal went through, is that, you know, we haven't gotten to this part of the book yet when Jack ultimately leaves Twitter. But, you know, part of the reason he ends up leaving is like there were some issues with him having two jobs. And there was definitely some irony that they weren't happy with Jack Dorsey, the CEO, two jobs, but they ultimately sold to Elon Musk, the CEO, with like six jobs. So that's kind of a funny irony there.
But the second stint as CEO, Jack was able to really inspire the workforce, emphasize the mission, and a lot of people bought in very well on that.
He did. One of the things I think he did best was solidify what Twitter's purpose was. You know, we talked about how it came about as sort of this like status update thing. And it had evolved significantly since then to when Jack returned in 2015. But I think people questioned, what do I use Twitter for, right? Is it for simply sharing what I'm up to? Is it for interacting with a particular community? And it wasn't always clear, and Twitter hadn't done a good job of making it clear what the service was used for. But when Jack came back in 2015, he really focused the company on answering that question. And I thought they did a good job. And in about 2016, they came out with the sort of slogan, "What's happening?" Right? Twitter is what's happening. And it was this idea that if something's going on in the world around you, whether it's a sporting event or a breaking news situation or even an earthquake or something, you know, the first place you should go to find out what's going on is Twitter. And I really think that's what people came to think of Twitter for moving forward, was it became the news hub of the internet, right? It was the first place you went to find out what was going on in a particular news event. And, you know, Jack should get some credit for sort of refocusing the company and making sure that that was the ultimate priority.
Well, Kurt, we've only got it probably about a third of the way through the book so far. Would you be willing to come back for our next episode of Book Talk and talk some more about The Battle for the Bird?
Let's do it. I would happily do that.
All right. Until next time. Kurt Wagner is the author of Battle for the Bird, which is published by Simon & Schuster. Please join us next time as we conclude our conversation discussing Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter and its effects. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.